all, I think when I say black hole or quantum gravity or something, I probably have something very different in mind than many people in this building would. I'm an astrophysicist that tries to understand measurements that we make with telescopes. So this normally is not usually mentioned at the same day as you mentioned quantum gravity, but I'm trying to understand. So I'm here not so much to give you an answer or a story, but rather to ask questions and to try to learn something, you know, about what it is or is not something that we measure. So I'm going to, in particular, one motivation that I thought makes this case particularly concrete is that the first pulsar orbiting a black hole was discovered about a year ago. Okay, pulsar was discovered orbiting the galactic center. So this makes this a new, at least, venue of exploration a practical question. There is something going around, and this may or may not be the right candidate, but you could imagine. The orbital parameters are not known. It's actually quite a number of Schwarzschild radii away, let's say like 100,000 Schwarzschild radii away. But there is a chance, if you're lucky, there's a 1 in 100,000 chance that the orbit will be occulted by the black hole. Okay, that's not a zero chance. We don't know that yet. And you can ask, you know, what will happen if you were to have strong interactions between the radiation of the pulsar as it passes by, whatever. Okay, that's the kind of the motivation, the background in which you know, we can ask questions. This is probably not the ideal candidate, but if we keep searching, we will find more black holes. More black holes and more pulsars orbiting more black holes. Okay, this is once you have one, there'll be more. There are clearly many more out there, and a matter of finding them. And before we find them, I think it's also appropriate to think about what we might learn. Okay, what could such measurements potentially tell you? And I've been in this context, I've been myself trying to learn a little bit about the general information problem, my view of how much I think I understood from talking to people or reading papers on what the possibilities are. I think there are many, many possibilities. Obviously, there's no shortage of discussion on what may be happening in or near black holes. And I'm trying to condense, you know, some of what I think may or may not impact astrophysical measurements. Okay, just want to go through the my understanding of what kind of things you would need to have something interesting happen. The pulsar that was discovered is, I don't know how useful that is. It's very astronomical. This is the coordinate orbit the black hole. It has been proposed by Rafikov, Lai, and many others that I think it's kind of obvious to everyone that if you have a good clock going around in a space-time, that is a way of testing general relativity. In fact, a Nobel Prize was given for a pulsar orbiting a pulsar. Orbiting a black hole can only get more interesting. So this is clearly it's an obvious one. The one paper I think was particularly struck my interest was the Rafikov and Lai calculation of asking, you know, how this impacts precision GR tests. And there, I think when we ask about one thing that I find interesting in the whole question is when you're testing something, I think it's important to think of what other outcomes you could possibly have. Okay, if you only have one possible outcome, it kind of becomes challenging to ask what is the question. You know, what parameter should I be measuring more accurately? You know, what are we going after here? If there's only one possible outcome, it's not half as interesting as if there are other outcomes. Even if they're not, they don't have to be really plausible. I think it's a different metric, right? A metric of saying what is the range of parameter space that is not actually forbidden, as opposed to what is likely. I think that's just to make clear that. That here we are talking, I'm trying to go explore what is not forbidden as opposed to what is likely. And I think in the quantum gravity, I think being open-minded may be interesting just to explore.
So if you're open-minded, then nothing is forbidden.
Nothing is forbidden, and let's go through and see how crazy we have to go to,
how
much we have to allow. My own short recap, just to just to show you how low level I'm starting off with here, of what little I know about black holes. But my understanding from our friend Steven is that, yes, black holes, it can calculate the force of gravity outside of a black hole, which is very similar to a Schwinger mechanism, very similar to a parallel plate capacitor where you've got a strong electric field. If your field exceeds 1,022 kilo electron volts, which actually is the case for high tension lines, then it's energetically favorable to produce electron positron pairs and move them to the appropriate plates. And that is allowed. It's not actually been measured yet, but people think this is probably observable in the next few years. People are building facilities to measure Schwinger mechanism of producing pairs out of a vacuum. Even that has not been explicitly observed, but I think I don't think anybody would doubt that this is what will happen when you actually apply a strong enough field, and it's going to happen very soon. So that doesn't seem to be the weak link here. If this did not happen, I think we would all be totally shocked. Now, near a black hole, you can produce, obviously, instead of using charge, you just have mass, and you have a stronger field, so you create, just like in the Schwinger mechanism, pairs of any kind of particle. My favorite particle is a neutrino, because it's simple, in my mind at least. It's not a particle that has spin. Potentially, there might be neutrinos which don't have mass. And you could ask, you know, what happens to these statistics of the spins of these neutrinos, for example, or the energy. In my mind, I'm. Why do you like the neutrinos more than photons? Photons are spin one particles. You could have multiple photons going around, high occupation number. Whereas with neutrinos, I'm almost guaranteed, like in the Schwinger mechanism, it's about electrons. Okay, so if I just map the Schwinger mechanism for electrons onto neutrinos near a black hole, it's almost identical, except that I've just replaced charge by either mass or just total energy. So I think that's got the simplest analogies. I don't have to delve into worrying about other things. And of course, real black holes could evaporate by other channels too, but they will certainly also evaporate by neutrino radiation. That's one of the things that can happen. And just simple, the two-spin system, there's certain simple things you can do with neutrinos. And when I talk about...
They almost certainly may not evaporate if they're massive.
If they're massive, then the temperature would have to be above the mass for them to have any significant radiation. And depending on what the mass is, you'd have to have a fairly small black hole. But whatever. So it's at this point, I'm still, even though as a physicist, it's not forbidden that they exist massless neutrinos yet. So it's a regime to think. So far it's just thinking about it, even for me. It's a bit more concrete because I like to put numbers on these. The typical temperature for a solar mass black hole might be a microkelvin or fraction thereof. You emit one photon of about a Schwarzschild radius about every Schwarzschild time. So in every millisecond, what I have in mind is a black body where roughly a black body, not a perfect black body, but something which emits a photon at a kilometer wavelength every millisecond. And if after you emit 10 to the 77 of these, the black hole's gone by energy conservation. Okay, so far so good. This seems pretty straightforward that an astrophysicist like me can at least deal with. That seems pretty straightforward. Now, also in textbooks, of course, we say this is potentially problematic if black holes have no hair and they're all identical. Then the photons that are actually coming not from inside the black hole but from just outside the black hole, might not know about the inside. And if the black holes are all the same, you might worry that the emitted radiation does not depend on how the black hole is formed. Okay. This might concern you, at least concern me, maybe, more than it might concern you, that you might lose sleep about, is there a microscopic time reversibility issue? Is there still a unique mapping of the future to the past? And you can put various levels of fanciness on it. It can be the causality, is the unitarity, different ways and different strengths of statements of stating, you know, the things. I think the most concise thing that I've been able to put my finger on is Hawking's description of discussing this in terms of a density matrix and just asking if there is this described by a Schrödinger equation that ultimately that I have in the past, I have no black hole, and the universe has some wave function, I form a black hole. It's difficult to know what's going on inside, but that's okay. After a while, the black hole evaporates, and there's nothing left. And again, there's a wave function, presumably describing the whatever comes out. And are these two wave functions related by a Schrödinger equation? And if they are, then an initial pure state remains a pure state. And if it's not, then it's not. Fine. So all that seems fine. I think obviously there's been a long history, 40 years of debate of what all the possible outcomes are. And apparently there have been many, many outcomes produced. My reading, and I think people here probably know this story much better than I do, is that Hawking seeded his picture that you create mixed states, I think primarily on the aesthetic argument that, well, string theory, and I think here it's a bit of a detail, it doesn't actually matter whether string theory describes our universe or not. Okay, I think for this argument that's not important, the way I understand it. Because in string theory, it suffices that in string theory, black holes do exist, or something very similar to black holes does exist, and they do evaporate, and they do have entropy, and they are unitary. Okay, so whether our universe is described by string theory doesn't really matter anymore. There is something that we think is self-consistent and unitary, which does evaporate and does seem to satisfy the Hawking evaporation argument. And Hawking has lost its bet, being it's not an inevitable outcome. It's clearly not inevitable anymore that you have to result in a mixed state. There's a counterexample. And so there's two different questions. Is our universe this counterexample? That I don't know, but at least. Weskill, is it? Weskill. So then. He did not accept it yet.
Preskill didn't accept he had won because he didn't find Stephen's argument for why Preskill had won to be convincing. At least that was his first reaction. I don't know if he eventually gave in and said, okay. But he was sort of bemused, I think.
Okay. But I mean, I can see the argument, right, that, you know, if I could at least see the logic that, well, you know, there are examples where Hawking's argument might not hold. On the other hand, maybe that's where Preskill would also say, the two burdens of proof, right? One is to say that there's an overarching logic that I have a unitary theory, maybe, and that maybe this problem isn't what Hawking thought. On the other hand, I think we're still not in clear understanding of why this Schwinger mechanism, this very semi-classical calculation, deep in the semi-classical regime, what's wrong with it? Okay, so it's kind of two impossible things colliding with each other. We're trying to understand what can you do to fix this.
Why do you say string counting is not possible?
If I take an astrophysical black hole and say, can you write down a string equation for a solar mass black hole and tell me where the correlations went? My understanding is it's actually pretty hard.
Well, they can't describe anything except extreme or.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why. I think that's what I was trying to. Yes.
I'm just curious. In the previous slide, you said that there was a risk to causality. Where is the risk to causality? Maybe in trying to get the information so to speak. Later on, there's a risk, but in the process of evaporation itself, I don't see why you called into question causality.
Maybe that's the wrong word to use. I'm thinking at the end of the process. If the final outcome didn't depend on the initial condition, then that's not a causal process, I suppose. But I don't think it matters for this.
We could just read it the same as non-unitarity.
Non-unitarity, yeah. That's what it means.
Doesn't necessarily mean sending signals faster than light or anything.
No, sorry, it's not a Lorentz causality that I'm speaking of here. So last year, or 2 years ago maybe, there was an amusing debate, and I think I understand it's still ongoing, about how to resolve potentially some of those issues. And my short summary of it is, well, one solution is you kill the messenger who wanted to prove that this doesn't work. If you want to prove it doesn't work, then you're just not going to survive this proof, or this delivery at least. And my understanding of this picture is that, well, the process of Schwinger pair creation is very straightforward. And the electrons and I create, or electron positrons I create, are in a singlet state and therefore have exactly anticorrelated spins. Simple. Therefore, the neutrinos you create also have perfectly anticorrelated spins. One goes in, one comes out. It may be in practice hard to measure much about the stuff that's going in, but at least I can collect the guys coming out and they have spins. And that's simple. So now after a while, I've got a basket of neutrinos coming out of there, and I can start doing statistics on those spins and ask, is there entanglement between the neutrinos coming out or not? The ones going in may be harder to measure. Now, in a unitary picture, at the end of the day, you have a pure state and therefore a density matrix of rank 1 and not rank 10 to the 77. Okay, that's a difference of 10 to the 77 in rank. And that's a strong entanglement. Every pair on in your covariance matrix is highly entangled. Okay, it's not a subtle thing that you have to collect a huge number of things, look at a huge number of things for. It's a very strong entanglement to have a pure state, even if you have that many particles. And this is my understanding is that what people are concerned about is that this violates monogamy of entanglement, because we just said there's perfect entanglement between the pair that came out and the pair that went in, and you also want entanglement between that pair that came out and something else that came out later, and that's just no good. And I think this might not be a problem. It's only a problem if you are the police trying to enforce monogamy. I think in Canada that's actually allowed, so that's not a problem here. What do you call it? Polygamy. There was a Supreme Court case where there was these Mormons in BC. The guy had, I think, 24 wives or something. The prosecutor took him to court, and the prosecutor lost. The court declared it's his life, and his wives were voluntarily, whatever. He didn't commit a crime. So in Canada, it's not a problem, but in other places, you know, they might send the police after you. And then the way I understand it is, okay, so you can ask the hypothetical question that, okay, sitting on the outside, I measure, maximal entanglement between the collection of neutrinos coming out. Therefore, I can ask the question, if I measure something coming out, and then I hop into the black hole and measure its partner going in, do I measure a correlation or not? Okay, if I were to measure correlation, I would have discovered that quantum mechanics was all bogus, and even though I will die an hour later, but at least I will have died knowing that quantum mechanics was bogus. And if you don't like that, you can invent a firewall, and then you just cannot complete this experiment. You can never discover the guys that violated your monogamy requirement. So it's a way of solving the problem. I understand that there are more technical arguments as to why these firewalls are motivated, but in the big picture, it's a way of preventing you from seeing macroscopic violations of correlations. And Hawking had an amusing article, where, again, these are all philosophical debates so far, so maybe I won't go into philosophical arguments. I'm going to go back to astrophysics. This is a little bit of a diversion. This is an argument that I read from Samir's papers, where he questioned the question of hair. And his counting of hair, he normally asks, well, what's the probability of seeing an object in a given state? And there's some amusing things that can go wrong. Normally, if you say, generically, my state of a black hole is a Schwarzschild black hole, at finite temperature, of course, we know that you can see fluctuations from it just thermally. The chance of seeing a big fluctuation, meaning of order or unity change in it, is suppressed by the change of energy that you think you're going to measure over the temperature that you think it's at, both of which may be a bit fuzzy to define, so this whole thing is clearly very fuzzy. But normally you would say, well, you know, it's highly unlikely to see a big change because the temperature is so low, and then you're going to exponentiate 10 to the e to the minus 10 to the plus 77, and that's so much less likely that you see a non-Schwarzschild outcome on a measurement than just about anything else you could imagine happening. I think, you know, us suddenly teleporting to the moon is much more likely than this happening than you seeing a macroscopic deviation from a Schwarzschild black hole. That's what Samir says, what you would normally do when you would stop at this point. But Samir says, well, this is not a self-consistent statement, because if you now look at you have to multiply by the degeneracy of states, we all know that too. The degeneracy of states is, you know, the entropy is equal to k log of the degeneracy factor. So if you think you know the entropy, which again Hawking gives you an estimate for, you find that this p-factor actually is of a similar size as the suppression factor. So it is not an inevitable, it's no longer inevitable that the black hole has no hair, even intrinsically. Okay, depending on what you think, how you think you're going to count these states, the no hairness is may or may not be in this, you know, this gigantic suppression may not be the end of it. Okay, so this, you know, this whole picture may not be bulletproof, and you may be this may be the biggest misestimate we've ever made. So reading up, if you Google for fuzzballs, that's the first image that comes up. That's what a fuzzball looks like, apparently. And of course, Samir and others have been debating, trying to classify, you know, the things that have to go wrong if you want to preserve unitarity, and what does it take to bypass the semi-classical Schwinger mechanism outside the black hole. And in fact, in the firewall paper, you know, a substantial fraction of the discussion effort goes about arguing why they don't like Samir, basically. That the entanglement of outgoing, so he is asking, could you entangle outgoing photons? And they're just saying, well, forget about entangling them, it's too hard. It's to the degree that matters, I think the program, this is an ambitious program that may or may not be in the right track, but at least in this kind of alternative picture, you could say, what else could you do if you follow this path, that there's really a huge number of eigenstates, which is the entropy that we're talking about, and each of these eigenstates is order unity different from a Schwarzschild black hole, meaning it's like it's a fractal or something, it's cubical, it's even worse, it's got stuff sticking out. And in such a scenario, I think he envisions this as a gigantic molecule, and the Hawking radiations are kind of transition between states, which is why when you coarse-grain over it in the Hawking limit, you see Hawking photons, and microscopically they're actually transition between states. And of course, in this picture, the information argument just goes away because you never had a horizon in the first place. You're just doing transitioning between states, each of which has hair. So you have maximal hair, and certainly the Hawking photons coming out just carry information, and it's only when you take this limit that it looks funny. And so it's I think it's a way of having a picture which just never had this problem in the first place. You freely emit radiation. And then the question is, if something like that, if there was, or more generally you can ask, if there's a process that can entangle outgoing radiation by order unity, right? We're talking about that the spin of the photon or whatever else, the neutrino that comes out, has to know something, has to be predetermined by other stuff having happened before it. And if that thing lives somewhere local to the black hole, you have to have some way of imprinting that information onto it. And it might imprint it not only on the Schwinger particles that come out, but perhaps also on bypassing particles, okay, on something which grazes the black hole. So instead of, we can now go back to the kind of argument that Bill Unruh has been making. There are two types of things you can do. The Hawking radiation is probably pretty hard to measure directly, even for an ambitiously thinking astrophysicist. But the scattering of radiation near black hole, that you can have arbitrarily powerful radiation. So pulsars, for example, emit in wavelengths quite similar to Hawking radiation. And you know, you can ask, as a low energy photon, or a large number of low energy photons, pass near the space-time of a black hole, do they also get the phases entangled by whatever you think is going to entangle the Hawking photons? Okay, if there's a mapping between those two, you might expect to see some impact on a correlation measurement.
Excuse me, but do these degrees of freedom live on the surface or on the inside of the black hole here?
I think it depends on which of Maslow's papers you actually read, but in his his fundamental statement, he is a non-local, is a supporter of the of a non-local interaction and near the black hole, but not at the horizon.
But I think they do live close to the surface. I mean, there is no inside.
Right. No, there's no inside. So inside is very different. But he does argue that you need. So if you think of the following, in far away, I've got a electromagnetic field from the Hawking photon that's radiating with a wavelength of a kilometer. I trace it back, and if I think of it as an antenna, in order to change the phase of it, I need to have a dipole change of order unity near the horizon. And if I don't, then in addition to whatever else you're going to get out, you still have the Hawking photons. Okay, so you have two challenges. You have to impart, you have to get the information inside the black hole out, and you have to prevent new black hole, new photons from being created and coming out. Okay, so you've got a double exercise, and by the way, Samir does backpedal on his own, and depending on which paper of his you read, but I think fundamentally he does say that it is not a small deviation of microscopic size that is sufficient. And that's, in fact, in the firewall paper, AMPS, they take his argument against him, and they say, well, you have the choice of having either order unity violations at order unity distances from the horizon. So at two Schwarzschild radii, you still have some non-trivial change. That's what AMPS didn't like about Samir's argument. So certainly many people take that.
So you're saying
the
unity violation close to the horizon is not enough?
That's right, exactly. I think both the firewall people and the fastball people do agree on that statement. That it's not a Planck, it is not Planck scale fuzz just above the horizon. It is order unity.
But also that the firewall picture is right at the horizon.
The firewall is exactly. So the way they get around it is depending on how you want to spin the picture. Is that you let go of the equivalence principle basically, and things just change dramatically as you you just maximally violate the stuff coming in. So you basically raise the state of the incoming particle is what they kind of want to do in order to allow the outside things to be entangled again. So if you were to follow,
I don't see the argument that all the arguments are based on what happens close to the horizon. So I don't see.
Well, the question is, what is close? Your Hawking photon has a wavelength off the horizon.
Well,
okay, so close means too far to
the
other way.
Out, huh? But then, it gets shorter and shorter wavelength the closer you get to the horizon.
No,
so,
the Schwinger. Okay, so in the Schwinger mechanism, the emission happens everywhere and has an about order unity probability. It doesn't peak at the horizon. You create a pair, one goes in and one goes out, and you can do nasty stuff to the pair that goes in. Yes, but what about the guys that went out? Okay, so that's the problem. That guy came from somewhere from the space outside. And it's a calculation which only depends on the outside. Okay, the Hawking calculation, you don't go in at all. Okay, the calculation, any change you make on the inside has, and you can calculate the overlap. There's no overlap between what happens on the inside and the stuff, and the guy that goes out. I mean, sure, the guy that goes in, we don't know, and that's what the firewall people want to say. You know, this guy that goes in, he just gets his state erased. And quantum teleported to the guy that goes out.
I think if you... I don't think there is any quantitative argument you can find anywhere as it should be a border Schwarzschild radius or...
Oh, I have a quote for that from Samir's webpage,
okay,
where he says it explicitly, and also in the AMPS, they say it very explicitly, that that's what you need. Okay. However, again, I'm not here to debate philosophical arguments here. I'm here trying to present what happens and what you could calculate and what you might measure and to debate whether... whether or not you can classify outcomes of measurements. Okay, that's why I actually want to debate here, because I'm not actually a quantum. Despite being in a quantum gravity talk, I'm actually not a quantum gravity person. Yes?
Are you saying that Samir is proposing a picture on which you would have deviations from the Schwarzschild metric on the distances of the order of a Schwarzschild radius from the black hole?
Yes.
But why wouldn't that be easily observed astrophysically?
Oh, because that's microscopically. So a Hawking photon at a time.
You said
that.
Order 1 dB. I said you said order 1.
Order 1, yes. Per Hawking photon. Per Hawking photon. But then if you actually say, imagine
I
put...
I'm talking about the geometry of the...
Well, yeah, understood.
Space.
Understood. So the quantum eigenstate is one which is order 1. But when you actually make a measurement, let's say I put a satellite in orbit around a black hole, okay, and then you're saying, well, the satellite is made of many particles, and then you see an average over whatever state that these guys probe. So the classical limits of macroscopic particles orbiting a black hole still looks perfectly Schwarzschild. So you distinguish between Hawking photons and between macroscopic objects.
So, I mean, maybe to go further. So if let's say it was permanently order one deviant from Schwarzschild outside up to a Schwarzschild radius outside of the black, I mean, up to two Schwarzschild radii. What experiment would you have in mind that would rule that out?
So it was permanently, macroscopically a different metric than anything falling into the black hole. When LIGO will see the when you will see
Avery's accretion disk measurement.
Yeah, accretion disk.
Yes, but none of them are good to better than a factor of maybe 2 at 6 Schwarzschild radii. Uh-huh. And if you take a multiple expansion, you find that sure. I mean, you can allow
You're assuming a non-spinning black hole, but then people argue that if they spin very, very, very.
Then you get the 2 Schwarzschild radii. But remember, these models are not. These are plasma physics models. That I don't think anybody would claim that even at 2 Schwarzschild radii, you could measure multiple bigger than quadrupole. I think even in the optimistic interpretation. So even if it is as extreme, I'm just trying to say, even if it were as extreme as some of those people propose or propose others to be, there is actually relatively little direct measurement today, especially because, at least in these pictures, you know, a macroscopic plasma orbiting it actually sees an average over these states, which might still be very round. By the way, this entropy business has an amusing application to, if you just go through the hydrogen atom, you have the same problem that our universe is at 3 Kelvin, and the transition temperature from the ground state to the excited state may be of order 10 EVs. The temperature is a milli electron volt, that is only 10 to the 4 in unlikeliness. Mm-hmm. It's actually E to the minus 10 to the 4, so it's E to the minus 10,000 unlikely of seeing an excited hydrogen atom in our universe. Now, as you go to higher states, the degeneracy goes up with n. Okay, so we can see that there exists some state which is much more likely than the ground state, even given this temperature. Meaning, you immediately convince yourself that the chance of finding a hydrogen in the ground state is exactly zero, ever, at any temperature. Okay, infinities blow up on you. Okay, it's inevitable. And it let it sit long enough, and it'll never be in the ground state. And the fact that we think we've seen it must be a mistake somewhere. Okay. Now there are solutions to this. Of course, there's Doppler, collision broadening, and other things that are happening that save you out of this. But I think these questions are sometimes very simple questions turn out to lead to non-trivial things, non-trivial understanding of what's happening. So I think just to say it's interesting to stay open-minded and see what might happen.
Yeah, but I mean, state counting without looking at the dynamics tells you very little. Otherwise, we'd already be in a heat death. I mean, everything would have collapsed into a black hole long since.
If the universe were eternal, yes.
The number of states of that is unbelievably greater.
Indeed, of course, we'd all be Boltzmann brains too by similar arguments. So it's, indeed, we should be careful with these statistics. So philosophical heart, I think it's hard to. I want to move forward now and discuss a much more astrophysical question now, and given this background of things that may or may not happen,
is there a prediction from this fuzzball picture that LIGO will not see the expected kind of waveform, or?
Okay, I'm gonna get to that question at least. I don't have an answer, but I'm gonna get to that question in a few more slides.
Okay.
So, this is, again, from the Wikipedia webpage of the Galactic Tender Black Hole. It lenses. In fact, laser here is, and others have calculated the geometry of photon. This has been known for a long time. Photon trajectories in a black hole space-time. But what's something new that allows you to make much more precise measurements than what we normally think, fine, you measure a deflection of whatever, some number of degrees, and you can measure, sure. But a possibility for making much more precise measurements than timing of pulses or just as a clock is to do a double slit interference pattern measurement. Okay, if you see the pulsar twice, this is like a double slit experiment. You see a pulsar image to the left and to the right, and they beat against each other. This suddenly allows you to measure the space time to a tiny fraction of a wavelength instead of some, you know, time pulsar period, which is usually very, very long. So this, you know, your immediate instantaneous measurement is a nanosecond divided by the signal to noise. So, you know, measuring it to a picosecond is trivial for in interferometric measurements. So picosecond time delays and measurements are routine, and they have been done. They're done daily with in pulsar scintillation measurements. And in fact, we have constraints on the smooth. This body, the best constraints we have on the fluctuations of space-time is pulsar coherency, not pulsar timing.
Okay. What sort of detectors do they use?
Sorry?
What sort of detectors do they use?
Just radio telescopes. What you see is the modulation of the fact that they do, that you can get perfect nulls in the pulsar interference pattern, means that the space-time was perfectly coherent. Otherwise, you can never get cancellations that go to exactly zero. And this exactness is something like 10 to the minus 5 that they've been able to measure to go down by. The flux, they can null almost perfectly, but if there was some fuzz left, you couldn't do it anymore. Okay, so there's so that's for multi-pass propagated pulsar radiation.
So this is through the ISM. You're talking
ISM.
About the different
the
path
ISM.
Through
in
ISM. Right?
In the, exactly. This is for plasma that is in the ISM. It's known that the space-time stays coherent.
Interstellar medium. We should say my ISM is here.
Interstellar medium.
Now we're going to do the same experiment, a thought experiment, or perhaps next time we discover the right candidate, a pulsar, which is lensed by the black hole and has two images that interfere with each other. And you can immediately calculate what this thing looks like. And I pick some parameters that are plausibly likely to be observed. That's what you do as an astrophysicist. And let's say I put it at a radius of 10,000 Schwarzschild radii. That's kind of just statistically something which is plausibly happening, which wouldn't decay by gravitational radiation and lessen the lifetime of, you know, various practical things. This is something you have a chance of actually observing. In inclination, I'd like to be about 1% in order to have two equal brightness images. Okay, at 1% inclination, it turns out the lensing geometry is favorable, such that you get a large effect. And then you can ask, do you get any entanglement of the radiation as it passes through the black hole? Do the photons entangle with the black hole space-time? And just from scaling the multipoles, you know, you might expect a fuzziness at the order of a centimeter for this kind of geometry if it is such a multipole decay of distance, which is a substantial effect on the scintillation pattern. So here I try to plot so the quantity that people measure this. So this has this is published for every known pulsar, not for every known pulsar, for every bright. Well, you know, anyways, this is something that people routinely measure with pulsars, and it's called the modulation index, which tells you how much the pulsar flux varies as a function of time and frequency because of multipath propagation. So just this multi-slit interference pattern I just described. And the modulation index can be 0 if your flux is completely constant, or it can be 1 if you have a perfectly aligned, you know, two identical flux images, then you know, you go to perfect nulls if the two images have the exact same brightness. Okay, that's modulation index of 1 in this, on this scale. And I have, this goes to actually about a half, not 1, because I have chosen my black hole not to be perfectly on axis. If it was perfectly on axis, you would get 1. I've allowed myself to be 1 Einstein radius off, so you get about a half maximum modulation index in such a classical orbit. And the black curve is the evolution you would see in this modulation index for those parameters as a function of time. So over a minute or so, you would see, as the images come and go, a change in modulation index by, you know, order of magnitude, let's say. Now, if your space-time was not the classical prediction is clear, unambiguous, and we know exactly how to calculate this.
You mean a classical Schwarzschild black hole?
A classical Schwarzschild black hole with classical photons propagating with no other effects. Okay, so if wave optics, geometric optics is all that's going on, and I can treat my space-time as just that, one can calculate this to arbitrary accuracy. I mean, you know, there's black holes can have a spin and a mass, whatever, but whatever, you can, you know, there's a small number of parameters, and there's a perfect measurement and prediction you make with very few parameters that you have to fit for. Now, as you go off axis, okay, what happens to the images is that you obviously always see the pulsar. Of course, it turns out that around a black hole, there's always a second image, no matter what the angle is. It's just that the second image gets closer and closer to the apparent, to the Schwarzschild horizon, and fainter and fainter. Okay, which is why the interference pattern drops off. Interference pattern is actually great. So even though this is dropped to maybe 3% on modulation index, that's actually a 10 to the minus 4 flux because you interfere voltages, not powers. Okay, so interference patterns are a good way of measuring small, faint contributions to your signal. And here's another scenario where as the other image gets close to the black hole, okay, at some point it starts grazing the black hole, meaning that any correction you think will get stronger. Okay? So what you expect is that instead of falling off as some predictable law, if there was any correction to it, it would it actually adds far away from conjunction, conjunction meaning the place where the pulsar passes behind the black hole, and you've got this perfect alignment of a double slit experiment. Far away from it, you would expect the maximum effect, okay, maximum deviation, because one of the images gets closer and closer to the black hole. That's what's happening in this bottom line. Well, so the proponents, so much the fuzzball papers, claim that their aesthetic high ground over firewalls is that firewalls violate the equivalence principle because somebody falling in hits a wall, which is not supposed to happen. So, this, you know, normally we think there's no sign saying horizon. They would say there is. And so the moral high ground is the first of all people say that they satisfy the equivalence principle through a complementarity principle that you know, a macroscopic observer, there exists a second frame where it actually all holds. So they claim that they satisfy the best of all worlds. So I've given them the benefit of a morally green sounding term.
So what is the actual model? The actual model is you cut off the flux with some power or some, what do you do?
No, so what I do here is I assume that you emit a Hawking photon, you change eigenstate of your black hole, and therefore you modulate the phase by a different amount of a grazing photon. So it's a maximal rate of change, it changes, that you have random phase changes on a dynamical time. Now, this photon is still not exactly passing by the black hole, so it's it averages over a number of these changes, and you just add random phase modulations, the way that, because the argument is that the Hawking photon of just the right wavelength gets order unity changes, so then you average these through and down and just make a random walk through the phase modulation to get this.
Is there significance to the peak height not being the same? Or is that just a choice?
That is because even when it's perfectly aligned, there's still a little bit of fluctuation left. And of course, this is a function of, you know, inclination and other stuff. So how high you actually go depends on the orbital parameters. There is also a prediction as to what the maximum modulation index is for a period. But there could be other astrophysical things that make this harder to interpret, like finite size of the pulsar. It could also decrease your modulation index. So modulation index is only one for a point source, purely plane parallel waves. Pulsars may have a finite extent, which could also impact things. So yeah, you have to be able to disentangle some astrophysics. It turns out if you look at current constraints on the emission size, you're probably actually fine. So with our current understanding, because we actually see plasma lensing of similar sizes, and it is coherent. So we think we're probably fine as far as the emission mechanism goes, but that's obviously things you want to confirm. But the important thing is that it's at large impact radius that you get a bigger effect, because one of the images gets closer to the black hole. That's the effect that one's going after.
Okay. So there must be some like more specific model that you have to get this, right? I mean, I guess I qualitatively get what you say. You say basically this black hole is kind of dancing around because every time it emits the Hawking photon, it kind of changes its geometry.
Yes.
But then, I mean, more quantitatively, but
yeah, are you treating first of all as static or dynamic?
No, it's dynamic with an eigenstate change every time you emit a Hawking photon.
Yeah. Is that what they want? I thought they also...
Well, I'm not sure that there is a quantitative enough picture of any of these really. To you know to describe this at this level of precision. But that's why you know to say that I don't want to read too much into the amplitude. I want to just say the qualitative statement that as the images, something which does happen is that one of the images will get closer to the black hole and the other one will get further away in the for these two images. And that's the thing you know you want to look at. Okay, this is I think more qualitative statement than necessarily. And of course you can measure pulsars at different frequencies. Hopefully you can find multiple of these pulsars to you know explore the space more quantitatively. Yes.
So just to be clear, no hair is what you're saying is like the firewall prediction for this, and equivalence principle is the first ball prediction.
Well, GR is always on the table.
GR
is not here. So GR is a black curve, firewall or not.
Firewall
yes.
is the same.
Firewall is,
okay.
is firewall satisfies no hair and GR.
Okay.
So that's why this, I think no hair, I think it's unambiguous. This is, in a no hair picture, that's what you get. Whether or not you call this equivalence, I think maybe a bit of giving them a lot of interesting sounding adjectives.
Wait,
they're not the only ones that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think so in this picture, you imagine it's in a single state and it's evolving from one to the next. But of course, with the number of states that the black hole has, we should always be thinking of this as a weak measurement problem. And you know, it's not all that different from making weak measurements in quantum optics. It's, one of the nice things that happens in weak measurement theory is it's easy to tell disparate states apart. So you should still see this sort of thing, even though that very very nice intuitive picture may not be quite right, because we're never going to localize it to a single state anyway.
And of course, there's a question of how long I think a single state lasts for these things. So it's not uncertainty. I think these are all qualitative statements.
Well, can I ask, so you mentioned just a little bit about the size of the spot that you need on the pulsar. Of course, it has to be very, very small scale or else it will resolve out.
That's right.
What about variability in the accretion flow right next to the black hole? Is that simply not coherent on the right scales?
Yeah, I couldn't come up with any other mechanism that is coherent because the closer you get, your emission size has to be smaller than the wavelength if you're right in front of the black hole. And it's hard to have a millimeter-sized emission that is actually dominate your flux. So pulsars are going through various possible emitters. Well, gravitational waves are actually another example which actually aren't in that limit. I'll get to that in a minute. But most plasma effects don't have the brightness temperature. So pulsars have the highest known brightness temperature in this universe. I think the number is like 10 to the 24 Kelvin or something is the nominal brightness temperature of the pulse. It's the highest known temperature. It's not a temperature. It's the flux. Yes, a definition of a temperature. So, the prospects of you know how hard is it to find one? We have there are 10 known pulsar neutron star binaries. These statistics for astrophysics get very messy because they're different types of neutron stars, different types of binaries. There's one pulsar black hole binary known now. You probably want to increase the sample by at least 100 because we want a 1 degree inclination. So even if you had a unity chance of finding one, if you ask people how likely is it to have a black hole companion, estimates vary between, you know, you should have found one already and you need maybe 100 more samples, to 100 times bigger sample to find one. So the chance of you finding one is uncertain, but most people think, yes?
So the closest that the light ray comes to the horizon is just is like 3 AM, at least for a non-spinning black hole. Isn't that true? I might be saying this. So they don't actually get very close to the horizon if you just try it. So your hope is then the effect is actually visible at 3 AM, not
yeah,
necessarily.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. The effect cannot be exponentially suppressed from the surface, in which case you do not see it. With just multipole suppressed, that's what I'm using here.
That would just count as no error.
Yeah, so I take a power law, just a power law effect as you would from Newtonian multiple expansion of power waves. So what could you do to find more pulsars, I think? You know, I think this motivation is fairly simple, that I think finding more pulsars orbiting black holes is probably a good thing to do, whether or not you're interested in quantum gravity. And as an astrophysicist, of course, this is the things that that get me excited about how we're going to find more of them, one way or the other. I want to advertise that the telescope being built in British Columbia. This is a picture taken 2 weeks ago. That's me. Anybody can tell?
Telescope. That doesn't look like you.
I also can add.
And this is a cylindrical transit telescope that actually operates in a very favorable frequency band for pulsar searching. Mm-hmm. It's 400 to 800 megahertz, where the pulsars are brightest and against the sky, biggest contrast against the galaxy. It has the fastest survey speed of any radio telescope ever built by about a factor of 1,000. So this will discover anything in that band a factor of 1,000 times more rapidly than anything built yet. Survey speed. So when we say we need a factor of 1,000 more pulsars, well, this is kind of the direction that you could take to get there. And this is just a start. I mean, obviously, this is a relatively modest sized telescope. It's a $10 million project.
How does it compare with Arecibo?
With Arecibo, it depends a bit on the hypothetical Arecibo or what it actually currently does. So Arecibo currently has a 7-pixel receiver that only operate at 1.4 gigahertz. The pulses are very faint at 1.4 gigahertz, compared to 400 megahertz. And this thing has 1,000 receivers instead of 7, but it's got a smaller collecting area as an RC.
Yeah.
So it's still roughly, that's about 1,000 times faster in
this is 1,000 times faster.
Yeah. Not to say that you could not build a low frequency array for Arecibo. That's why it's a bit of maybe an unfair comparison.
Right.
One could also make Arecibo much faster.
So how do you get over interstellar electron scattering? So, I mean, at long wavelengths, I thought the problem with observing galactic center pulsars was effectively...
And for galactic center, here I'm hoping to just look at stellar mass binaries.
Oh.
So for stellar mass binaries, they should be as detectable as any random pulsar. And again, they are expected to be slow pulsars, so they're easy to find. Just need a big enough telescope to computationally straightforward, so these things should be fairly simple computationally to uncover. And you can build much larger arrays, so this is just the beginning, and you could build something 100 times bigger at a modest cost.
But the wavelengths you'd require would be drastically different for a supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy and a solar mass black hole, right?
So here we're going after this random pulsars going around random small black holes with something like this.
Right, but is the wavelength of emission of pulsars compatible with seeing both? I mean. So you were arguing that the pulsars emit just the right wavelength to get significant.
For the black hole, that's very hard. That's a million kilometer wavelengths, which, that's not clear that we've ever seen effects there. So that's the distance, but not ideal. But it's a motivating thought that, yes, it's mostly to motivate, yes, pulsars do exist. It may or may not, it's probably not the right one.
Okay.
Questions about other observables that may or may not be impacted. LIGO, would fuzzballs ever impact what LIGO sees? I don't know the answer. I don't even know how you even discuss that question. I would say at most, the maximal effect I could envision maybe happening, or speculate on happening, is that if you could think of decomposing somehow, I'm not quite clear how you would do it, of decomposing the background from the emission of gravitational waves. Okay, imagine in addition to having a mass, I put some charge on them and I propagated the electromagnetic radiation coming out of this binary black hole through. That I can do at least. Then there I can make a similar estimate as I did for the pulsar case that, there is a background and I'm propagating something through. And yes, there'd be an effect, right? If I just charged up the black hole and looked at the magnetic radiation, the effect is maximized at the very last orbit. When the wavelength actually is similar to the Hawking, when all time scales become similar. Early on, of course, there's such a long wavelength radiation, it probably couldn't care less about what's going on at the horizon. There's only the very, very final plunge that could possibly care. But of course, the very final plunge may have a lot of signal in it. Okay, so, and then you have to think how you would ever disentangle of what's propagating and what's just dynamically changing. Not clear how you would even, calculate this or even pose. Not clear that that's a well-posed problem. But it is clear that, LIGO, it would be interesting if LIGO saw a deviation from a purely gravitational template.
What about two black holes, inspiraling black holes?
That's what I meant, two inspiraling black holes.
That's what you're talking about.
Exactly. Okay? In the case of two inspiring black holes, I can, it's even speculation here, I can only say it may be different or it may not be different. Not a very useful statement.
So the problem is string theorists are very careful to not make testable predictions so that we won't be able to tell whether it's detectable or not.
So wouldn't this show up as a dispersion among the way gravitational waves effectively going around the more massive object? Or just pick one, right? So there's a self-force where gravity is getting lensed by the gravity from one object is being lensed by the other object, and there's a phasing that's important in that process. And wouldn't this show up as a dispersion in that phasing, which would then show up as a
sure, but if you make an estimate, just using these multiple expansions, at any radius more than the last stable radius orbit, the effect actually is very small, and LIGO is not predicted to have secondary noise of, you know, 10 to the 5 or something, which is what you would need to see a small effect. It's, so the effect, you have to wait for it to become large for LIGO to have a chance, because they're not talking about, you know, if secondary noise were a million, they would have, LIGO 1 would have seen them already, so it's probably, you know, probably going to be faint. Now, the very final plunge does carry substantial power that they may see depending on the mass of the black hole. So I think it's interesting to ask the question, but I do think it is a very last orbit. A very last, not in orbit, the very last in plunge, where the scales are most matched, where you might see an effect. And there, it's not even clear that there's an interesting expansion parameter. You could even, where you, not even clear how you do a numerical GR simulation of it. Nothing is obvious. How you even discuss a problem. But just open-minded, it's interesting to think that you might get a different answer. That's the level at which I can speculate here. So yeah, how would you think of it? I don't know how you would think of it. There's the Event Horizon Telescope. Of course, Avery here is the expert on that one, which is an effort internationally underway right now to link up several millimeter telescopes to actually get resolution to see the, you know, Schwarzschild size structures of the galactic center black hole in the microwaves. And there you get, you know, order unity strong lensing, meaning the typical photon you see nearby may have turned 90 degrees by the time you see it. And there, if there was, and those guys, you know, do come within a few m of the horizon as well. So maybe you would start seeing fuzzy things, depending on what exactly. You know, that's about a big if, but at least it's interesting that that this is again a development which is happening as we speak. So some of the biggest telescopes like ALMA are being linked up to achieve this kind of resolution. So I think it's just a matter of a modest amount of time before we will have data on both of these. Both LIGO and CHT are coming online. And, you know, it'll be interesting, now is the time to speculate of how different things could possibly get. And I think, you know, Neil has been the person who has always encouraged me to think about the alternative outcomes that can happen in our universe. And I think here, I've taken this message and here just to think about, you know, the alternative outcomes that that might come out. Good, so this is it, you know, I'm thinking, could there be, you know, can one think about what the outcomes could be, classify what would have to happen to give an outcome. And I think this thing is, you know, it depends on many things that are not known. But at least it's a regime that will soon have data. You know, as I said, new technologies coming online, and new surveys coming online, and we may have many more things that we can measure. And you know, I think there may be some scenarios for which there may be an outcome. Okay, so this is clearly, you may, of course, you may just measure the GR, classical GR is the only thing that's happening, in which case you wouldn't have learned any, well, you would have learned something, but it would be more interesting to see a deviation than to just see GR. And it's, you know, that's the picture that I want to encourage you. Thank you.
So I guess I just want to make an argument that for why I wouldn't expect to have see deviations or have large deviations far from the horizon. And then if they say the generic state looks very different from Schwarzschild or from Kerr at like three times the horizon radius, then how do you get the area as entropy? Because area, of course, some geometric property of kerometric or Schwarzschild metric. But if all your solutions are very different from Kerr or Schwarzschild at the horizon, then it sounds like a coincidence that somehow if you count all of them, you get the area of a Kerr.
Okay, so in those pictures they're describing, in an eigenstate, okay, if you prepare the black hole in an eigenstate, then the entropy is exactly zero, that's a
yep.
pure state,
yep.
and it has no horizon and no entropy, and that question isn't really there. Okay. So in a pure, if you prepare in a pure eigenstate, then you know, things will just happen and there is no, and this problem doesn't
right.
exist.
Yeah, sure.
So entropy comes because there are these vast number of states,
sure,
each
exactly.
of which is very, very different, and at the end you conclude, you know, by if you fix mass and variable over all the other ways of generating this entropy, each one of them doesn't have a well-defined horizon, but the collective gives an entropy, which we then plug back into Einstein's equation, and we infer that, you know, that's the Hawking-Bekenstein formula you get by microscopic counting. And in fact, it is those arguments that, you know, these guys, that even the first world people use the standard and stringy counting arguments. Now, the trick is that the catch is that you can really only do these constructions for very special cases. You know, for the zero entropy, if it's a pure winding mode, maybe you can actually calculate something. A generic mixed mode, then you know, you're hard pressed to even talk about what it might look like. So those guys, they don't actually have a, you know, to answer this question, it's not as if they can write down all 10 to the 77 solutions here. They write down one extreme end, the other extreme end, and they conclude it's true that neither of them has entropy and neither of them has a horizon. And in between, you know, depending on who you ask, they'll say that these guys are crazy, those two spaces are so special, they tell you nothing
yeah.
at all about the in-betweens. And, you know, in the fastball program, though, the picture would be that maybe this microstate description holds all the way, and there is no issue with, you know, this Hawking picture was just the wrong
yeah,
picture.
No, I understand. I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying that this sounds like a very big coincidence that you're counting 10 to the 77 states. They, none of them look like Schwarzschild, but somehow the number comes out to be the area of.
Okay, that's a posteriori because it's like saying it's a big coincidence that string theory happens to get back Hawking-Bekenstein right. Okay, that's the but that's already a posteriori because he already got it right. So we know the answer that counting it does give you the right answer. That's already known. Okay, that's built into the
I think I'm disputing.
For extremal black hole.
But I'm disputing
your
that's the ones you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about. But yes, all this, you know, all this, it's the same question you're saying, will string theory get the entropy right for an astrophysical black hole? And I guess the answer is we don't really know, but they got it right in some regime, presumably the same counting. So they will have the same arguments, but they have a different interpretation of what those arguments lead you to, right? I think it's a difference in the interpretation, not a difference in the argument that it's based on.
But I think Nyash's question could be said another way. Sorry. How can all these things which look nothing like a Schwarzschild metric average out to be a Schwarzschild metric? Is there any well-defined sense in which that average can be taken?
Yes, so in the Masuch fuzzball argument, not that I understand their constructions or anything, but they do give the examples of the two extremal things whose average happens to look much more Schwarzschild than they do individually.
And how do you average it?
I don't know how they take averages of metrics, but it does sound a bit fishy, but they do make these statements.
With the Event Horizon Telescope, what are you imagining there? You're imagining that like you actually look at a black hole and it doesn't look completely circular and you can actually measure the shape of it? What kind of thing are you imagining?
Well, the expert is, of course, Avery here. I think the essential ingredient is that you have high resolution, and there are different scenarios of things that you think might happen. Okay, there's a static case of what it might happen in if you just have the time invariant setup. I think a more another, but that of course is a function of both the space time and what you think the plasma did before you put in the lens. Okay, so if you don't know either one. You have to come up with ways of understanding the space-time independent of your emission plasma, which may be doable, but of course, Avery is the expert. But there are other things that could happen, which is if you could have flares. In fact, we know that the flares do go off near the black hole. That's observed. So you get short-time, hour-long, whatever. I think the flares last for minutes, isn't it? Near the.
It depends. I mean, they at least for half an hour in some cases. But that's just.
So if you're lucky and a localized flare, localized in space and time goes off,
mm-hmm.
that's a bit like a pulsar.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be coherent. It will not cause interference pattern. But you might see a flare. You might see an echo of the flare coming the other way around. Okay, and then you might be able to ask, you know, is there the images? You can do a position comparison of the images possibly, and ask, you know, is the dilation exactly what you predict from GR? Because GR makes a perfect prediction of how these things dilate.
Because you're not actually the shape of the horizon, but you're using the fact that you can see the horizon to image things near it, and they would do different things. So it's still a kind of, you're still talking about the lensing of things near the horizon.
Yeah, I guess. Sure.
It's always a lensing experience.
Mm. Okay.
We're talking about how the lens horizon shows up in the images or impacts.
I mean, there are also, of course, conceptual challenges that these photons now have much, much shorter wavelength than the Hawking wavelength. And some people, like Samir, like to argue that this thing is, you know, he has no constraint because those photons can do anything they want. They never come out of the black hole anyways. So they could see yet a different description of space-time than the Hawking photon. So that's why when you match it, okay, then you're really asking, I'm propagating a photon of the same wavelength as the Hawking photon, so do you modify both, or do you modify neither? Or do you modify one and not the other? Okay, I think so that's why in the matched wavelengths, there's a more direct comparison than having very different wavelength scales.
Can you say again, what is the argument why a flare and its counter image won't interfere with each other? But a pulsar will, because what exactly is something about the size?
Yes, the size of the empirical known size of both of these, and the brightness temperatures you would need. So for a given, first of all, we know empirically how bright either, how big, not yet at least, you know, how bright either of them are. But yeah, the temperatures you would need for them to show an interference, you know, if you're small, for the same flux, it's going to be much hotter. And the temperatures you would need are very high, both for pulsars and for the plasma flares. And not that we know any of these, it may well be that they could be very small, but the requirement that they really have to be a millimeter in size for them to show an interference pattern in the case of a galactic center flare. In the case of the pulsars, they'd have to be, you know, 100 meters in size or less, and that seems to be consistent with current pulsar measurements. The pulsars are known to be tiny, it's much longer wavelength, so they can be bigger. Okay, it's just the empirical constraints on how, and they are incredibly bright. In temperature.
From coherence across a finite size source, that if I have a very large source, coherence puts a constraint on how far an angle apart I can view before one side becomes incoherent with the other side. And if I look at an object right next to a black hole, I'm seeing it from very large angles, and so I need coherence. I need the object to be sufficiently compact.
Well,
you
can't look at this flare at lower wavelengths because the atmosphere doesn't.
Well, that is certainly true. Yeah.
And what is the rest of it?
Well, so if you knew, so those pulsar scintillation experiments, you don't really need the high resolution, right? Because you can just treat the whole thing as an adding interferometer.
That's exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And so you don't really need high resolution, but you do need to be able to see the thing. And these flares, if they're happening near the horizon, would be behind the photosphere.
Can you say something more about the observational? You told us that using the interstellar medium, similar observations are already made. Can you just expand on that? You know, what exactly are people observing?
So pulsars are observed to scintillate. So it is known that if you look at a pulsar at a given frequency over time, its flux goes up and down by a factor of several. It can go down to almost zero, and it can go up a factor of, you know, 10 over the mean, over its mean flux that's just observed. And recently, people actually have made VLBI images of what the pulsar actually looks like when you have very high resolution on the propagation. And you can see multiple images of the pulsar, which were lensed by things in the interstellar medium. By plasma lenses, presumably. And so you see maybe a dozen images of that pulsar, and they interfere with each other, and it is this interference that leads to the brightening and fading of the whole system, of the flux itself.
So you're saying the scintillation is due to interference?
Yes, the scintillation is due to the beating of the images against each other.
It's not intrinsic to the
pulsar. It's not intrinsic to the pulsar.
Wow.
And it's a timescale picosecond? What did you say?
No, the time, the frequency is a gigahertz, so the wavelength is a pico, the time of the wave of the electromagnetic wave is a pico, is a nanosecond.
Okay.
But the length, the coherence time, how long you have to watch this guy before the flux goes up and down is typically a few minutes. So if you watch the pulsar for 10 minutes, the flux will go up and down over that time. It's not constant. It's actually changing.
So you don't need high time resolution to see the scintillation.
That's right. Not for ordinary pulsars. Yeah. After a few minutes, it takes a while for them to change.
So the scintillation is due to the motion of the plasma, or
it's thought
or
to be dominated by the motion of the pulsar itself. So typically, a pulsar moves at very high speeds. Again, the reason is not well understood, but they just do. And it's thought that these lenses are frozen in the plasma, and it's a motion of the source relative to the screen. That's what thought to be the cause for the time variation. And it's consistent. I mean, these pictures, if you actually put in numbers for how wide these separations are and how fast it's moving, it's a self-consistent picture with all of these phenomena.
And this picosecond you mentioned is the instrumentation in the interferometer, is that what you're saying? The very long baseline interferometer?
When I say picosecond, is the constraint you get because you say that the modulation index goes to almost zero, meaning there are times when my light rays completely cancel each other.
Yeah.
Okay. So if there was an uncertainty in space-time between the two light paths that they went through, then they can never lead to perfect cancellation anymore. So that's why we can say that the change in path length is less than a picosecond. Otherwise, we wouldn't be observing these strong, these perfect destructive cancellations. So once in a while, it's not very often, but if you keep watching, once in a while, the flux goes to exactly zero, consistent is what you predict from just a double slit. It goes down to very, very close to zero until it's hard to measure zero very accurately. You've got noise, obviously, in your detector at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But it does go down all the way to as low as it could possibly get, and that's why you get a constraint much finer even than the wavelength. You get constraints to a small fraction of the wavelength. So picosecond, and if you convert that to a strain, it's actually h of 10 to the minus 20 something that's already empirically required by pulsars. So we know that the metric is in fact one of the best constraints we have on smoothness of space is the scintillation that's been observed.
So are you comparing it to
10 to the minus 20?
Yeah, but h, so just metric fluctuation, strain.
Okay.
So your strains greater than 10 to the minus 20 would spoil the...
Exactly, would spoil the perfect cancellations that you do see.
But it has to be gravitational waves of wavelength shorter than this.
On a particular scale, yes. This is on. So the typical separation between the two paths can be as big. Obviously, it varies from pulsar to pulsar, but can be as big as 100 astronomical units.
Right.
So across 100 AU.
Isn't the distance important? Isn't the area of the interferometer most important?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why you take what you use. You take the picosecond and divide it by the transfer scale. And that number gives you 10 minus 20. Okay.
But just the transfer scale. The distance from the source is not important.
I'm using it as a transfer scale. If you use the distance of the pulse, you get a much bigger number, but I'm not sure that's meaningful, simply because what would you have to put in? You'd have to, if I just take some mode modulation, I would have thought they fit in the same mode. If it's a very long perturbation, there's no reason to think that my two paths would have a different dependence.
It's a small angle
approximation. Yes.
Path length.
And the path length, yes.
Yeah, so I measure path length difference, and I use the transfer scale, and that's what I measure. And I'm not using line of sight because, sure, that could give you even better constraint, but I'm not sure that's meaningful.
You would be constraining noise in the path length.
You are constraining, yes, okay. I'm constraining the transverse separation,
right.
Okay. But it's for a transverse, so I'm constraining the longitudinal modulation in distance
mm-hmm.
at a fixed transverse separation.
Okay.
Okay, so I know that the time it took to go through these two paths changed by a small amount for two paths separated by 100 AU. Now the path is very long, and you could say, well, I also know that over this long time, but these two guys go on always identical path. So if you just say I have a perturbation which is a kiloparsec in size, well, they would have the same effect on both paths. So you wouldn't really expect, I mean, unless you have a highly contrived, you know, obviously I might be able to set up a very strange system, but that's why a generic constraint is 10 to the minus 20. In a very special geometry, you might get a better constraint.
So are you saying the path lengths have to be equal to that degree, or are you saying
the path lengths are unchanging?
That fluctuations in
should
the back length should be bounded by the, and so is your model that the sort of incoherent fluctuation, and that's why it's destroying the interference?
Yes.
If it was a coherent, like in this fuzzball, maybe it may.
Okay, so then again, that time scales. So the function of both it's in the parameter space, so I know the transfer scale, I know my frequency. And then what you get to constrain is the modulation pattern. In fact, actually, you can do better than that because this modulation pattern has to be periodic. So you can even see how quickly it goes into another null again. So you know that the relative lengths didn't change by an amount, and the naive scaling you would choose is you say, something which propagates at the speed of light between those two paths. So that would be an hour or something for 100 a couple of hours for 100 AU. Then you say over a couple of hours, these things are stable. So if there's any disturbance which propagates, which has a correlation length of a few light hours, that's what you're constraining. So yeah, you could allow for other fluctuations on other timescales, but on this characteristic time and space scale, we know that the geometry is stable and leads to a consistent, repeatable interference pattern.
No, what I was asking, you said you put a bound on H.
On fluctuations.
Fluctuations.
At a given time scale, a given spatial scale.
Fluctuations.
In a.
If they were coherent fluctuations, would that bound still apply, or is it? Do you need to assume that?
Okay. By coherence, I say this is a difference in H between those two paths that I'm constraining. So if they go up and down together, they get no constraint. That's why when I say scale, I mean a change of scale, for two paths separated by 100 AU.
Okay,
if they differ, I can see something. If they use the same, yes, then that's why I put the scale in. So coherent, I would say the scale is bigger, right? If your wave was 1,000 AU, I would call that a bigger scale.
Yeah.
And yeah, you couldn't tell.
Okay, let's talk about
it. Yeah, no, I think in astronomy, when we talk about scales, that's maybe a different concept than in Planck units.
I mean, but in coherent disturbance, the metric would change this simulation pattern. It just wouldn't maybe destroy it as a noise. Coherent.
Yeah. You have to be specific. And you can quantify these. I mean, it's a well-defined thing you're measuring. And the constraints, yes, depending on, you can define what your constraints.
Right. There are other questions. Very urgent. I will. Of the day, and thank our speaker again.